The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Pete Fader, author of The Customer Base Audit, the first step on the journey to customer centricity. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a free copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Peter Fader to talk about the book he has co-authored with Bruce Hardy and Michael Ross, The Customer Base Audit, the first step on the journey to customer centricity, published by Wharton School Press. Peter S. Fader is the Francis and Paywan Cha Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. His expertise centers around the analysis of behavioral data to understand and forecast customer shopping and purchasing activities. He works with firms from a wide range of industries such as telecommunications, financial services, gaming, entertainment, retailing, and pharmaceuticals. In addition to his various roles and responsibilities at Wharton, Professor Fader is also co-founder of Zodiac, a predictive analytics firm which was sold to Nike in 2018. He then co-founded and continues to run Theta to commercialize his more recent work on customer-based corporate valuation. Peter is the author of Customer Centricity, Focus on the Right Customers for Strategic Advantage, and co-author with Sarah Toms of the book The Customer Centricity Playbook, which was featured on episode 222 of the Marketing Book Podcast in 2019. He has been quoted or featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, the Washington Post, and NPR, among other media. And interesting fact, he was a math major at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Dr. Fader, congratulations on the customer base audit, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, it is always a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm just really excited about this new book and everything that it represents.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to interview you. You have been mentioned, as I keep you updated, on the Marketing Book Podcast over the years, particularly when I interviewed Neil Hoyne about his book, Converted.
Sure thing. Neil is great. He does a wonderful job of not only spreading the gospel of these customer-centric ideas, but making them very, very practical, which is what I'm hoping to do in this new book as well.
Absolutely. It's very practical, and it's not even a long book, which my hat's off to you, because those must be even more difficult to write. There seems to be a growing number of Wharton folks on the Marketing Book Podcast. I'm so honored. I've interviewed you twice, Jonah Berger twice, and then other folks who I think are adjunct professors like Robert Chen and Douglas Cole, and then several other Wharton grads. So they're really coming out of the woodwork, and I really appreciate that. So, you know, go Quakers.
Yay.
And I recall that after I interviewed you before in our house, you know, there was like a one or two generations of clutter that had been handed down to us. I found a University of Pennsylvania Glee Club album from the 1960s that I think I sent your way. And you said,
did send me. That was so great, because it turned out that one of my students was an officer with the current Penn Glee Club, and I actually gave it to him, and he was just so thrilled because they actually do have kind of an archive of a lot of old content, and he said he had never seen anything like that before.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So clutter turns into treasure.
Yes.
Much appreciated.
Got it to the right place, and I hope they enjoyed that. My wife is from Philadelphia, and she grew up there, and her dad had the album. So we'll get into the Eagles later on. But so when I'm reading your book, I'm thinking about a person I knew, gosh, over 30 years ago when I was I was an assistant account executive at the J. Walter Thompson Ad Agency in New York, and you know, big international agency, and they had hired this young woman as another assistant account executive, and she was from Spain. And her family was very wealthy, and they owned a big shipping company and several businesses, and I think that they had one of their businesses was a client back in Spain, so they called the New York office and said, hey, can you hire this young woman? She's, you know, a friend of ours. And so they said, sure, you know, you know how it works. Well, they were trying to hire. And so she was very funny, very creative. I'm not sure she really wanted to be an account executive. Anyway, one day her boss, Jim Brubaker, was talking to her, and they were looking at all these spreadsheets and competitive spending data. And she said in her Spanish accent, I told you people when I got hired here, I don't do numbers. And I think those are, you know, kind of harken that was back maybe the tail end of the Mad Men era, but that was something that I found interesting. But this book has some math in it, and there are charts, there are graphs. I want people to understand that
math is a wonderful thing. Math is a really cool thing. So get off your ass, let's do some math. Math, 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 math.
Since you were a math major at MIT, it's further proof that marketing has gone from Mad Men to Math Men. And there is a bit of math here. And, you know, if you're a marketer and you're not comfortable with math, you're probably in the wrong line of work. You probably shouldn't be listening to this podcast. But the other thing that came to mind in this book is a study from the Fornays Group, I believe they're in London, maybe 10 years ago, where they analyzed the perception of marketers by CEOs. And it was very interesting because only 20% of CEOs trusted their chief marketing officers. Mm. In that, what they meant was they did not trust that their marketers were in touch with the financial realities of their business. And that was quite an indictment. And so there was another book on the show a few years back called The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader by Thomas Barta and Patrick Barwise. And Barwise is a professor or a professor emeritus at London Business School, where Bruce Hardy and Michael Ross both teach. Is that right?
That is true.
Yeah.
I think he's retired now. But
okay.
He's actually very influential in some framing my own thinking.
Oh, well, so in that book, they analyzed a lot of McKinsey data. Barta had worked for McKinsey and they went even deeper into the perception of marketers. And the answer to the problems that marketers were facing is to get in the revenue camp. Whatever you do, get in the revenue camp. They said that repeatedly throughout the book, and they gave examples of very successful marketers who are in the revenue camp. And this book is one of those books that's going to get you a very comfortable seat at the table. It will get you in the revenue camp. So that's why I was so excited to be able to interview you about this. And we're going to talk about this. But it also occurred to me that every CFO should read this book. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Well, and that's a big objective right there, isn't to just appeal to the marketer, some of whom might be math phobic, but to help the CEO frame what marketing should be all about, and basically to impose a vision on marketing and the rest of the organization, that marketing is accountable. And it's really less about math, but it is about data that we can make definitive, you know, yes and no statements about things instead of just waving our hands and saying it depends a lot.
Right. Make the logo bigger. So I was an English major in college, but I still had to take a year of calculus and a year of chemistry. And this book is not calculus. The math, I think, is addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. I don't know that it goes too much further than that, but you have to go get the numbers first.
That's a great point. And I really want to emphasize it, because most of the work that I do is more mathematically oriented, does involve the calculus and the integrals and lots of Greek letters. There's none of that in this book at all. This book, as we like to say in it, is unashamedly descriptive. All we're doing is describing the data that exists right there at the fingertips of every organization. And just how do we frame it? How do we describe it? How do we draw inferences from it? The math, the real math, would follow. You know, once we understand these patterns, then the question would be, how do we project them? How do we optimize and all that kind of thing? And again, that's a lot of the work that I do, but not in this book. Let's go back to the subtitle of it. It is the first step, literally the first step.
Yes.
On the journey. So let's just kind of organize our data in a sensible way that will then give us the foundation and the motivation to then do all that mathy stuff if you should choose to do so.
Right. So reading the book, I know this sounds weird, it reminded me of back when I was in the Army years ago, and the first time I ever put on night vision goggles. I saw things I hadn't seen before, and I wanted more. I wanted more. So I want to quote from page 175 towards the very end of the book, and then I want to quote from the beginning, and then we'll go through it. So you write, "Imagine looking at your business under a microscope. That is what a customer base audit is like. It provides deep insight into customer differences and dynamics that have always been there but were typically not visible. On seeing an audit of her customer base, one CEO remarked that it was like looking at the heartbeat of her business. This reaction is typical because the audit gives business leaders an entirely new perspective, insight that either did not exist before or was buried deep within an analytics group, but never seen by key decision makers." And then I want to go to the very beginning, page one. You write, "As a senior executive, you will be very familiar with your organization's key financial statements and monthly management reports. You have spent countless hours discussing budgets and expenditures. Focusing on the top line of the income statement, you will probably have looked at sales by product line and geography. You quite possibly have looked at product profitability as part of a product line rationalization exercise. But how much time have you spent reflecting on the fact that these revenues are generated by customers pulling out their wallets and paying for your products and services? What do you really know about this primary source of your organization's inward operating cash flow? Consider the following questions." And these are really important. How many customers does your firm have? How many customers do you really have? How do these customers differ in terms of their value to the firm? For example, how many one-time buyers did you have last year? How many customers accounted for half your revenue last year? How many customers who bought your product last year can be expected to buy from you this year? What proportion of your sales this past year came from new versus existing customers? On average, what proportion of your new customers have made a second purchase within 3 months of their first ever purchase? Within 6 months? A year? Which of your products are most appealing to your most valuable customers? If you are struggling to answer these questions, you're in good company. In our experience, most senior executives are unable to do so, regardless of whether their organization is primarily business to business or business to consumer, sells products or services, or is a for-profit or nonprofit. Peter, why is that the case, do you think?
Well, it goes back to the Mad Men era, because back in the old days, and for some many companies still true today, they just didn't have the data available to them at that granular level. They could not pull out the microscope and use it. They could just only get those very coarse, very aggregated top-line reports. How much stuff did we sell?
Right.
But there was no visibility at all to say, well, who did we sell it to? So it's quite understandable that the origins of marketing didn't really have a lot of this customer level stuff as foundational. You know, we talk about customers in some singular way. You know, the customer is always right, but we wouldn't know anything about how they differ from each other, how they change over time. That has only become possible since we invented the microscope. And truly, when I was an undergrad at MIT, math major, this one professor came up to me, Lee McAllister, her name is. This is 1982. And she said, we are in the process of inventing the electron microscope of the customer. And we're going to have just so much rich data, you know, even if you don't care about the implications of it, even if you're just like playing with data and building models, which is kind of me, we're going to have so much for you to play with, and no one else will have ever seen it before. We're not even sure about what questions to ask, much less the answers to them. So it really was just opening up an entirely new field. That was 40 years ago. And we've come a long way since then. The electron microscope has not only proven to be true, but it's getting better all the time. But it's now it's a matter of getting companies to actually use it and prioritize it and make it an important C-level exercise and not something that's just buried among the analytics folks deep in the organization.
And was that epiphany at MIT what started you down the road to marketing?
Oh, there's no doubt. This professor, Lee McAllister, she's my fairy godmother, because before describing the electron microscope, she looked me in the eye and she said, you should get a PhD in marketing.
Wow.
And I looked at her and said, you should get your head checked, because I'm a math guy. I'm a numbers guy. The last thing I'm going to go into is marketing. But she was right. And again, she was a visionary in terms of seeing that future. And really leveraging it, and not just waving her hands in some fairy tale way, but saying go after it. And for me, it was very much right time, right place to not only have a mentor like her, but this is just when all the top business schools were starting to realize we need people who can help build and leverage this electron microscope of the customer. And that's what led me to Wharton, and the rest is history.
So you mentioned, and you write in the book, that firms aren't undertaking this type of analysis first because managers haven't really been exposed to it much. So
right.
We'll get there. But also, what do you say to folks who say we don't have the data or it's too difficult to get the data? I assume you're getting a lot of pushback from companies.
Well, of course, those are two very different excuses. And the first one might be true. There'll be a lot of cases where it's just impossible for either technology, legal, ethical reasons to tag and track individual customers. There are concerns about that. Of course, that difficulty, that challenge is one of the things that kind of keeps me gainfully employed, is trying to figure out, so how can we squeeze as much insight as we can out of limited data sources? So mm-hmm. we could kind of go in that direction. But the second excuse, the idea that we can't prioritize collecting that data and building a culture around it, that one infuriates me. Because there are so many companies that really do have a lot of this data right there at their fingertips, but they refuse to prioritize it. And that's just really problematic. They say, yeah, we could, and occasionally we do, but it's just not important to us. You know, we have a business to run over here, and kind of spending all our time in the weeds thinking about, customer A versus customer B, that's not going to help us move this enterprise ahead. And I'm not exaggerating.
I'm not sure they can be helped with an attitude like that, though.
Yeah, and that's why I really believe that the overall revolution that we're sparking isn't one that's going to happen with the writing of a book, but I think it's more of a generational type thing. I think that the kind of the mid-level managers, I'm hoping that everyone will read the book, but the mid-level managers who do so, tomorrow's CEOs will bring a lot of these practices with them, and there'll be no more excuses, there'll be no more barriers, and of course, the technology for the tagging and tracking and the kind of granular understanding is going to only continue to get better. So I got the long run on my side, and I really believe that even if I'm not here to enjoy it, a lot of the practices that we're talking about in the book, I think will become more rule than exception within, let's say, 10, 15 years from now.
I don't see how it can't be other than that. But there'll be a lot of kicking and screaming and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Let me mention one thing, though. This isn't just for really, really big companies. You write on page 5 that if you have a small transaction database, fewer than 1 million transaction records, you can even do this on Microsoft Excel, like you do with your MBA students.
That is right. It's really interesting. A lot of my students who like the math, who want to code things up, they're saying, hey, can we do this in R or Python? And I'm saying, well, you can, sure. You know, go ahead, do that on your own. I have no objection to it. But let's face it, Microsoft Excel is still the lingua franca of business. And if we can't get it done there, and if we can't convince people of the importance and value of these kinds of patterns, then it might not be worth doing. So virtually all of the analyses in the book can be done in Excel. And my co-authors and I are working on the sequel already.
Oh.
It's going to be basically what we call the cookbook. It's going to be just that. So now that you understand the nature of the audit and all the steps associated with it, now let's get into the nitty-gritty details and show how we can do all of this stuff in Excel. So there's, again, one less excuse for companies to avoid doing so.
And you write that Bruce and Michael now co-teach a course at the London Business School that covers many of these concepts. And I recall at the end that they give them like 12 hours to do the whole thing.
Well, they teach the course. It's a regular course, but at the end of it, they'll have kind of a data hackathon.
Uh-huh.
And they've been doing this for several years. It's one of the things that really propelled the writing of the book. They've been effectively having their students do a customer base audit, but it was just a little bit less crisp, a little bit less organized. And so as we sat down and came up with these lenses and frameworks that we'll talk about, and then basically say, okay, students, go to it. It's an amazing exercise, and I really can't wait till it's fine-tuned enough over there so I could borrow it and use it over here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a course like that and an exercise like that, again, is going to become a common part, not just of marketing elective courses where it is now, but it should start showing up even in the marketing core. It should be within your first 10 weeks of learning marketing, you should be getting your hands dirty with customer-level data. And I think that will not only change the way that we do marketing in practice, but it will also change the kind of people who do it. So the math phobes that you were referring to before, I think it's going to be a wake-up call for them that they either have to bite the bullet and learn this stuff or find a new profession. But we don't want marketing just to be that place to go if numbers scare you. Quite the opposite.
Yes, we're talking about arts and crafts party planners who work in the Make It Pretty department. TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flipped the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a free copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. Talk about how companies struggle with the answer to the question, how many customers do you have?
I love that. I love it. I love it. And of course, there's a story in the book that I will share right now.
Oh, with the rental car company?
The rental car.
Loved it.
It's an absolutely true story. There is no exaggeration whatsoever And I'd love to name the company and the particular individuals involved. I probably just shouldn't do that. But here's the way it goes. In the research center that I used to run at Wharton, we ran the customer analytics center, and it was great. And we'd basically help companies kind of raise their quantitative literacy. And one of the companies we worked with was a rental car company. And we sat down for our initial meeting just to kind of get an understanding of their different data assets. And our research director said, you know, just a very simple question. She said, how many customers do you have? I mean, that's not a controversial thing to ask. And
how many unique customers, I think.
Exactly. Right? And everyone's sitting around looking at each other. And she's saying, come on. You're like, you know, how many rows in the spreadsheet? You know, how many customers? And they're all looking at each other. But here's where it gets interesting. She then says, how many cars do you have? And with like one voice, they say, I don't even remember the number, 432,174. They all know exactly how many cars they have. And it was just wonderful because the CEO, he hears this and he literally pounds the table saying, this is unacceptable. How can it be the case that we know how many cars we have, but we don't know how many customers we have? And he goes on to say, you know, we don't make any money from the cars. We make our money from the customers. So it's at least as important for us to know how many customers we have as cars. And I think a story like that, well, that was just an amazing, shining moment. And again, I can't give my former research director, Ellie Feit, enough credit for kind of reframing the question like that. But I think that kind of conversation, well, is either not happening at a lot of companies, which is just tragic, or the same thing's happening, and then they just kind of move on from there without having that you know, pound the table wake up call that this particular company had. And we're hoping that this book is not so much a painful way to get people there, but more of a positive, opportunistic way that there's gold in them there hills. Mm-hmm. There's interesting stuff under that microscope. Let's explore it.
Yes, and there's also other issues. I'm sure they were struggling with it. Is it who is the actual customer? Is it the person that flies on the plane, or is it the person that booked the flight? There's a lot of things to struggle with there, so we acknowledge that.
Yes, we do, and we get right into that in Chapter 1 without being able to come up with a clean, crisp answer to it, asking what and who is the customer, and we lay out a scenario and basically asking the question, for which of these brands that you use or interact with, are you actually a customer of them? And too often, companies have a really hard time forgetting about the numbers, but just even defining who the customer is. Mm-hmm. You know, so is it the person who makes the purchase? Is it the person who actually does the traveling and so on? And this will happen in many, many industries. And again, that's going to be a factor that just paralyzes companies into a state of either ignorance or complacency to say, well, it's hard to figure that out, so let's not bother. No! Let's pick one of those entities, or maybe do this in parallel for more than one of them, and come up with the answers and look at the insights. And one of the things that's really nice is that a lot of the patterns that we describe in the book, a lot of the pictures that we show, are amazingly robust, that even if we defined the customer differently, we'd still see the same things. So saying it depends isn't really true. The basic idea that most of your customers, however we define them, are and don't really do that much with us or for a very long period of time, whereas it's this small set of customers who do everything and do it forever. That's kind of a universal pattern. And so it's important to anticipate seeing that regardless of what customer definition you use.
Right. Well, let's go through the five lenses in the book are really the backbone of the audit. And lens one, and we can't go into great detail here, but just conceptually, lens one is a single period analysis focusing on all those customers active in that period. So what would be an example like all the customers within a month or a year?
Exactly. So just imagine you have all your customers in a big old spreadsheet where the rows are customers and the columns are time, you know, and so how many purchases did this customer make in that unit of time? And so let's just take a vertical slice of it. Let's just cut across the whole customer base and basically say, how many customers made zero purchases this period versus 1 versus 10 or 20. Mm-hmm. Let's just take that vertical slice and understand at one point in time how the customers differ from each other in terms of how often they buy, how much they spend when they do, how profitable they are, how often they're using discounts. So just a lot of fairly basic questions that we should want to know. And that a lot of companies are currently doing, which is why it's only lens one. But even then, we could bring more rigor to it and do it on a more regular basis to make it, you know, part of an audit, force ourselves to do it, not only when the need arises. Let's do it because it's just something that should be done regularly.
Yes, and let me add to that. You write on page 47 and 46, it's very misleading to talk about the average customer. Such a person is not representative of your typical customer, to the extent that there is such a thing as a typical customer at all. And just before that, you write, too many executives do not understand the level of variability in buying behavior and value across their firm's customer base. Can you briefly talk about distribution and decomposition to help folks get away from that average customer concept?
Sure. So there's two pieces to it. So one is just the spread. And look, everybody out there, every one of your listeners is familiar with the 80-20 rule. They'll even quote it. But have they ever looked for it? Have they ever looked at their customer base and said, so if we look at the top 20% of our customers, how many of the purchases are they making, or how much of the profits are they bringing in? So it's that kind of thing. It's just that there's tremendous spread. It might not be quite as extreme as 80-20. It usually isn't. But still, it's enough spread that you can't just think about the average customer. And then I'm so glad you mentioned the decomposition, that instead of just looking at just overall revenue or overall profit from a customer, it's important to break it down into, you know, how often they're buying, you know, how many transactions are they making, how many different products are they buying on those transactions, how much are they spending when they do. I mean, two of the key metrics, and this is almost an acid test for your listeners, are AOF and AOV, average order frequency and average order value. Now, once again, we got to be careful about averages, but that's why it's a 1-2 punch. Let's first break down purchasing into its underlying components. You know, how often are you buying? How much are you spending? And then let's understand the spread along each of those dimensions. That's lens one. That's kind of basic blocking and tackling that every company should be doing on a regular basis. That there are some insights there, but more than anything, they're really just setting the stage for the more insightful stuff to follow.
Yes, and let me conclude this discussion of lens one with a quote from page 52, which got me fired up. To see and acknowledge the existence of the small but powerful set of customers who buy more frequently at greater average order values and at slightly higher margins than the vast majority of the customer base. Companies that ignore these differences across their customers do so at great risk. Alternatively, those that are able to recognize and act on these differences are sowing the seeds for an effective and sustainable growth strategy.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
See, that sound clip, Doug, that is taken right from my first book. So, you know, I kind of jump right into book number one, customer centricity, focus on the right customers for strategic advantage. I'm taking those points as given. Just, you know, hey, your customers aren't all equal, so let's leverage it. Let's dive in and take advantage of it. And that's why this book, the new book, is, once again, the first step in that direction. Let's just look at our – don't trust me, okay? Don't trust me at all that we have these customer differences. See for yourself. And so do a customer base audit, and then boom, there are the differences, and then boom, you can start to leverage those differences.
Yeah, and don't get overwhelmed. You know, the secret of getting ahead is getting started. The journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step. If you are just sitting down thinking about who are our real customers, you're already way ahead.
That is right. And that's why, I got to tell you, the real story behind this book, I was curious about it. As we were finishing it up, I searched through various emails and found a message, excuse me, from Bruce Hardy from 2005, already laying out some of the content for the customer base audit and using those words specifically. Because it really was back then that we were first basically discovering not just the existence of these patterns, but the generality of them, the universality of them, and saying, we need to do something about this. It took us 17 years, but better late than never. It's nice to have it all out there now. And now, again, I'm trying to make this the law of the land instead of just a nice-to-know kind of exercise.
Yes, and I appreciate the patience while you feel like you've been taking crazy pills for 20 or 40 years.
Yeah, and a lot of people still say that, but we're getting there.
Yeah, yeah. So the next one is lens two is period versus period analysis, focusing on all those customers active in at least one of those periods. So in other words, like let's say it's 2 years of data. Somebody may only buy once every 3 years, but it's two periods. What kind of problem does this help to avoid, and talk about how this lends a little more stability to your analysis.
Sure. So let's first root it in current practice, because as we're recording this, the holiday season is right around the corner, and so we're going to hear so many references to same store sales. I mean, retailers are talking about it all the time, but especially over the holidays. So how did this holiday season compare to the previous holiday season? Let's take one slice of time and compare it to the previous one. So businesses get that. We don't need to motivate the importance of doing that time versus time comparison. But boy, oh boy, oh boy, it becomes so much more insightful instead of just doing it at the overall level of sales. So sales are up. Great. Congratulations. Well, is that because we have more customers than we did before? Or they're buying more often than they did before? Or they're spending more money when they do? So let's take the idea of same store sales, or again, any period over period comparison, and just dive deeper into it and understand the customer level drivers that are causing those changes over time. It's as simple as that. That's why it's kind of a natural part of business. We just don't see this kind of more granular version of that analysis done as often as it should be.
Right. And you talk about, I'm going to use a term here, but I don't want to throw people off, multiplicative decomposition of profit. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that's really asking like four questions where just to demystify this, like you were talking about one, I'm looking at page 66, where for each customer, like if you're looking at 2018 and 2019 data, like you did for the example that you have throughout the book, is their profit greater than or equal to the previous year? Did they make the same or more purchases in the first year versus the second? Is their average spend per transaction greater than or equal to their the year before? And is the profit margin greater than or equal to the earlier year? So just answering those questions, it seems like you can really, really get far along with lens two.
You can. The idea of the up-down analysis, as you just described it, again, we didn't invent it. It's funny that I've sometimes talk about it, especially now that people are starting to read the book. And I heard from someone at a big consulting firm saying, we do this routinely with our clients. Well, that's great. That's good. So number one, are they doing it? Now, granted, the consulting firm wants to do it for them, but why aren't more companies doing it themselves? And number two, can we fit it into a broader array of analyses instead of just making this one standalone thing? What are the kinds of analyses that should precede it? What are the analyses that should follow from it? So let's have a whole suite of analyses. That's the customer base audit. It's not just here's just a bunch of stuff you do, but there's a natural sequence, a natural building that happens with
it. Mm-hmm. So those first two were vertical, as you mentioned, vertical slices. The second two are more horizontal. So the lens three is a single cohort analysis, tracking over time the behavior of a group of customers born in the same time period, meaning they became customers, let's say, during a one-year period, and then you continue to track them beyond that. Is that right?
That's right. And what do we call that group of customers who are born at a certain time?
A cohort.
A cohort. So again, the word cohort isn't new to anyone's vocabulary, but sometimes managers will kind of mash up cohort and segment.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. And they're very, very different concepts. So the segment would be a group of people, and it's kind of more the vertical slice thing. So here's a group of people, and just, you know, what did they all do? Regardless of whether they're newbies or whether they've long-time customers have been with us forever. And that could be a problem because we see some natural dynamics for customers or for a well-defined group of customers over time. So when we compare newbies to well-tenured customers, it's a bit of apples and oranges going on.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a horizontal slice of our spreadsheet and say, here's just this group of customers. We're not saying they're all the same by any means. No, no, no. They're going to be different from each other. But because they share this one very important characteristic that they're acquired at the same point in time, or, you know, the same very narrow slice of time, watching what happens with them can be very instructive. And once again, we see some very regular patterns about how a cohort evolves. Usually, it's pretty grim. And this is a really important point, because we watch a cohort over time and we ask, how many purchases do they make and how much do they spend? And we ask those same kinds of decompositional questions. And it tends to be that they just get worse over time. And again, it's not a universal rule. We're not saying that this happens with all customers and all companies, but it is a pretty strong expectation that you should have, that each cohort is just going to kind of drift downwards.
A lot of one and done customers?
A lot of one and done, or some who might be three and done, but for whatever reason, they either no longer have needs for your product or service, or a competitor swoops in and takes them away, or they move, or they die. I mean, who knows? But for a variety of reasons, customers tend to slow down over time, which goes very much against the grain of the kind of traditional marketing fairy tale that we're going to do whatever we can to acquire this customer, and then we're going to educate them why they should get better and better, and we're going to cross-sell, and we're going to upsell, and we're going to make them more and more valuable over time. And it sounds so nice. It sounds so romantic, but it's generally not true. So let's understand the realistic, but maybe grim trajectory that most customers follow. Really, really important implications there. Again, this is the kind of thing that Bruce Hardy and I started seeing 20 years ago, wondering if what we were seeing was exception or rule. But at this point, it's entirely rule. And what's great about it, you know, we keep talking about how we want this book to either be motivated by or appealing to the folks in finance. A lot of those folks are starting to wake up to the idea of a cohort. A lot of people, a lot of investors in venture capital are starting to ask these kinds of cohort-based questions to try to understand those dynamics within a cohort at a cross, which is our next lens. So this is lens three, again, just understanding cohorts and how we look at them. It is,
and don't conflate them with your existing segments.
That is right. Exactly right. And we'll say more about that. But lens three, you know, kind of understanding the nature of a cohort, that is literally and figuratively the heart of the audit. It is the central lens. And really, if I had to pick one, I'd say that's really the one to focus on.
Yeah, interesting. Well, while we're still on lens three, we'll give it a little extra time here, given it's important. Talk about an approach that has its origins in the age of catalog retailing called the RFM analysis. This seems very helpful. And why the order of those three letters is so important.
Yeah, it goes back to, again, we want to give credit where it's due. We don't want to say that we're coming up with all of these things for the first time. But our forefathers in direct marketing, they understood this cohort kind of thing very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
They were just really good at it. So, you know, we think about direct marketing just in terms of those late night infomercials and the, you know, occasionally schlocky products that they sell. But if you look underneath that layer, behind the scenes, they were just brilliant about doing this kind of stuff. Unfortunately, they kind of kept it to themselves, and it was associated with a kind of less desirable marketing sector, and so everyone else would kind of ignore those practices.
But I tell you what, Peter, David Ogilvy was a big fan of the direct marketing people.
That is true, true, true. And you know, and a lot of the agencies that you know of and that you've referred to would always have the direct marketing practice. Sometimes there was a bit of separation between them and the kind of creative types, and we're trying to build a better bridge there. But one of the great things that our forefathers in direct marketing came up with, basically they wanted to understand for a group of customers, how valuable are they going to be in the future? Things like, you know, customer lifetime value, something that I spent a lot of time focusing on. And way back when, we're talking 1960s, 1970s, they said, what would be the leading indicators? What just simple observable data can we look at to say, what are the KPIs for valuable customers?
And you have this data.
Exactly. Easy data. They had it in the 60s. You have it in the 2020s.
Yeah.
And it was that came down to RFM, recency, frequency, monetary value. If you can simply tell me when is the last time this customer bought from me, how many purchases did they make over the last, say, 2 years, and how much did they spend on average when they made those purchases, boom. It's going to be incredibly predictive of future lifetime value, and it's going to give you a really good basis for segmentation. So let's group customers based on RFM and then treat them differently and develop different products and services and messaging for them. So it's just a natural part that goes along with this cohort idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lens 4 is a cohort versus cohort analysis, comparing and contrasting the evolution of buying for two groups of customers born at different points. So that could be like tracking a cohort from 1 year and tracking a cohort from the next year. Is that right?
Or it can be, again, talking about the holiday season, let's track the cohort of customers acquired during the holiday season versus one, the previous or the next one that was acquired during regular business times. Mm-hmm. How do they play out over the next year or two? And you'll see some big differences there. Lens 4 is probably the least common, the least appreciated of them. You know, we spoke before about Lens 2, comparing the two vertical slices, but comparing two horizontal slices, two cohorts, you don't see a lot of companies doing that if they're doing the cohort thing at all. And it's really, really important to see, you know, is this cohort better than the one that preceded or worse, and to understand what that says for the business.
This struck me as a possible canary in the coal mine. Could you talk about how this particular lens can act as an early warning sign of degradation in the overall customer base that might not be visible if they're only looking at aggregate data? Maybe
it is so important. And here's a story I don't think is covered in the book, but it's one that I live every day. Again, you mentioned the current company I'm running, Theta. This is what we do. We generally work with a private equity firm looking at some company that they want to buy and saying, just how healthy is that customer base? And this kind of quote-unquote Lens 4 analysis, how the customers are changing over time, is so important because the canary in the coal mine metaphor is perfect. Here's a company. We just did an analysis recently for a women's cosmetics company, for a European private equity firm. The unit economics, the overall profitability of the customer base is actually quite strong. But we told this PE firm, you might want to stay away from this one. And it's for exactly the reason that we're talking about. That while for the most part their customers are quite profitable, it looks like their recent cohorts are falling off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
That the most recently acquired cohort of customers is actually substantially worse than the cohort acquired just before them. Now, we don't know why. Is it because they're overfishing the waters and there aren't good customers to acquire? Could it be competition? Could it be that they're changing their marketing activity? There's a lot of reasons why, and of course, we'd want to understand them. But when we see this happening for, you know, several recent cohorts, each one getting substantially worse than the one before, That's telling you an awful lot about the future health of the company. So the current profitability might be great, but when you're buying a company, in a big sense, you're buying it for the not yet acquired customers. And if they're not going to be as good as the ones you've been acquiring, you probably want to stay away from that. So this kind of lens for analysis, you know, comparing one cohort to another, it's actually really vital. And once again, sounding like a broken record, companies should be doing this kind of thing routinely. The problem is too many companies don't do it until they see a big difference. Like, oh my gosh, our overall profitability is going down. I wonder what's going on. Well, it turns out the last six cohorts have been getting substantially worse. Too late. It's over.
Right.
So you want to be doing the customer base audit on a regular basis so you get that early warning sign that there's trouble with the new customers.
Right. So last lens, number five, is a multi-period analysis in which we focus on multiple cohorts. And I wanted to mention from page 124, you write, "This exercise provides very useful insights into the underlying patterns of buyer behavior that lie behind the revenue numbers in your basic financial reports." And then you go on to give an example on page 109. You're comparing the four different years of data, looking at annual revenue and profit for the past 4 years. And then you write, while 2017 was not a massive improvement over 2016, seeing a 7% growth in revenue and a 4% growth in profit, 2018 and 2019 were much better. For both years, revenues were up by 21% and profits increased by 18% and 22%, respectively. And then you write, "We should be happy, shouldn't we?" And then you say, "Maybe, but maybe not." So continuing on, what is it that this fifth level can start to help people understand that things might not be quite as rosy as they were thinking, perhaps by looking only at aggregate data?
Yeah, it goes back to the private equity story that I just shared.
It
could be that in the aggregate, things are going up and moving in the right direction, but that most recently acquired cohort of customers, even though they're just a small part of the overall customer base, and therefore you don't really see their impact or any dynamics associated with them relative to the others, that should tell you as much about the future health of the company as all those aggregate numbers do. And of course, going from just comparing cohort A to cohort B, but bringing in cohort C, D, E, F,
right.
Basically playing connect the dots across multiple cohorts. You know, because when you do the one cohort to the next comparison, it could be that this year's cohort a little bit worse than last year's. But you might say, well, that's because of, you know, recessionary fears. It's because of lingering COVID. It's because of competition. And it might be easy to dismiss just a year-over-year cohort difference. But when you see it happening for many cohorts, you can't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all that's going on in Lens 5. The entire customer base through the lens of basically the vertical slices and the horizontal slices. So you know, we understand that most analyses for most companies are going to be for the customer base as a whole, but let's just make sure we're looking at them the right way with the right slices to really understand what's going on.
Right. Well, just going on to this one part that's after the lenses, you talk about how this, you know, the five lenses help shift your orientation of new ways to think about your firm's revenues and profits. But you all answer a question that I had been wondering while I was reading it. You've been ignoring a rather fundamental reality about the product. Talk about then entering in the product dimension.
Yeah, there's a couple of really important points here. So one is you do the audit and you see all these patterns and everything. Yay! So there'll be a natural question, so what? You know, so how do we start to take action on it? Okay, go out there and acquire more valuable customers. Well, thank you. You know, you didn't need to do an audit to know that. So one of the reasons why we bring back the product dimension in Chapter 8 is to give just at least an initial hint at the so what and to suggest other so what's that could emerge. So instead of just looking at which products sell the most, kind of the obvious thing that most companies do, let's start to link products back to the lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start to basically just go back to lens one and say, you know, we got some customers who buy a lot more and a lot more often than others. Well, are they buying different products than the light buyers?
You know, well, what are they buying?
Exactly. What are there products that are, I don't want to say uniquely, but disproportionately favored by those higher spending customers? And this is really important because let's take the opposite products, the ones that are favored by the light customers. There's a lot of light customers out there, you know, 80-20 rule. And so it could be that these products are selling quite a bit, but they're appealing to the wrong kinds of customers. And so if we go to our R&D department and say, get us more products like those, well, we're creating kind of a bad spiral here, that we're coming up with products that are going to be that much more appealing to so-so customers, and we're going to acquire more of them, and we're going to lose sight of the fact that some of these lighter selling products are actually the ones more appealing to the stickier customers.
Mm-hmm.
So part of bringing back the product lens is just further insight, just more interesting things swimming around under the microscope, but with a very strong action orientation.
Right, particularly informing your customer attraction strategies. What is it that, what's the gateway drug?
That is right. And a lot of companies are starting to ask these questions, but again, it's important to ask them in a richer, granular way. Don't just say, okay, what are the products that appeal to the high-value customers? But again, breaking it down to understand, is it associated with greater frequency, greater spend amounts? So let's get into the science of how a product buying varies by customer type. And that can be very, very informative for us. Again, not only to know just in general which products are better, but even as we want to go to R&D and talk about specific kinds of product features and product messaging, how we can do that more effectively.
Yes, and before we wrap up, I just want to ask about a couple things from the last chapter. Well, this was a little troubling to me, and I was wondering what advice you have for marketers who are listening, who are trying to do the right thing. You write, too often businesses view all things customer-related as a marketing issue alone. In practice, creating a customer-centric mindset should be at the heart of how the entire enterprise is run. Have you seen marketers who are trying to pull their organizations in the right direction have success with any particular approach at getting this disconnected just from the marketing department and make it more for the whole enterprise?
Well, that's been my job for a long time now. And again, I go back to the company that I'm running these days, Theta, the idea of customer-based corporate valuation. You know, the main noun there is corporate valuation.
Uh-huh.
But if we can do it in a customer-based manner, we can do it more effectively, that we can forecast revenue over longer horizons with a better understanding of what's going on. And again, we're not doing any of that formal valuation stuff in this book. This is the first step.
Right.
But building the bridge to basically show the folks in finance that they can't just leave marketing to the marketers, that they really need to be thinking about these customer level, these five lenses themselves, that they want to take at least as much interest and responsibility for these things as marketing. It's not so much that they don't trust marketing. That might be the case. That's a separate conversation. But it's going to help them do their jobs more effectively by understanding the sources of all that inward cash flow.
You know, it just made me wonder also when I was reading the book about what would happen if a marketing person who reads this book then shares it with their CFO. It seems like it could start a very interesting conversation.
We really do hope so. We've had great success, again, on the customer-based corporate valuation side, getting CFOs to pay attention and so on. But I want it to be more than just corporate valuation. I want it to be day-to-day activities. And mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I just love the audit metaphor, that it's just something that we do, something that we have to do. We maybe we kind of dread doing it because it's just imposed on us, but at least we do it. And you just think about all the people in the company that are involved in the audit and the, you know, outside agencies. And maybe we're just doing it because, again, it's required by some, you know, accounting entity. But companies should be doing audits on their own, just because it's a healthy thing to do. Mm-hmm. So the idea of doing these kinds of activities on a very broad basis and with real regularity, that's what we're aiming for here.
In the conclusion, you talk about loss-making customers, which I found interesting. And it just occurred to me, do you find that when companies start to understand that they're losing money or even hemorrhaging money on a large swath of their customers, that they then start to pay attention to the things outlined in the book?
Well, it's similar to what we said before, that sometimes you don't know about it until it's too late.
Right.
And so, you know, we talk about that with respect to the cohorts, but even if we're just looking at segments, we're going to find that within every cohort of customers we acquire, there are always going to be some of those, you know, opportunistic, cherry-picking, loss-making ones. How many are there? B, how is that changing as we acquire more and more customers? And C, how does it tie in with the activities that we have full control over, like holiday discounts and things like that? So part of the audit is to help us see that more carefully. And instead of making excuses and saying, oh, well, you know, that's just part of doing business, it's something that we actually can start to take control over and have some accountability for.
The conclusion really was strong, and it had several interesting case studies, I guess, that you all have worked on, where companies thought they were losing money on a particular channel or a certain thing they were doing or certain customers, and they realized, no, wait, they're actually keep that. Like the one example of a retailer, they thought they were losing money on their stores, but they didn't realize that the stores, even though people were buying online, the stores were playing a much bigger role in the purchase and the customer attraction than they realized. So they kept the stores open.
That's right. I've seen this a lot, especially with some of the, the digitally native direct to consumer retailers, the Warby Parkers and Bonobos and so on. That opening stores makes great sense. That even if the stores, if you just look at their profitability on their own, might be questionable. Instead, if you look at the mix of customers who are buying through the stores, as opposed to those who are buying online, you'll see things in a very different light. And of course, that could be true with stores, that can be true with channels, that can be true with products. And so it's just something that we should be looking for in lots of different ways.
Warby Parker, weren't there a bunch of Wharton guys?
Absolutely. And I remember so well when they were in my office back in 2009 and I was kind of rolling my eyes at them, you know, like, really selling cheap glasses? That's the best you can do? What a mistake on my part. But I did give them that piece of advice saying it might not be on your radar right now, but you must open stores. And that's really been whether they'll give me any credit for that, I don't know. But for a lot of companies, again, not just the digitally native and so on, stores often have a different kind of role, mm-hmm, than just looking at them purely as a profit center.
Right, like they would have in years past. So, Peter, if readers took only one thing away from the book, and I know that's an unfair question, what would you hope it would be?
Well, it takes us right back to the beginning of the conversation, which is to say that there's I don't want to call it math because that scares people away, but the data on our customers, it's tangible, it's visceral. There's it's really valuable that we really should view our customers as tangible assets. Companies don't put customer type metrics on their balance sheets and income statements, and I can understand why. I'm not making statements about accounting here, but at least internally, we really should look at our customers as tangible, and we should measure them and manage them like we measure and manage other hard assets. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, "Oh, it depends," or "Oh, you know, they're humans, and we can't view them that way," we can and we should.
Well said. What is one thing a listener can do today just to get the stone rolling down the hill, to put in action one of the ideas from your book, perhaps while they're waiting for the book to arrive?
lens one. take a vertical slice of your customers and just see how they differ from each other. Just come up with that histogram. How many people are buying from you only once a quarter versus 10 times a quarter? Look to see if the 80-20 rule applies. And of course, we go much deeper into it in the book, but that's something that you could get going with but before you crack the cover of this thing. And I think a lot of people, if they're just willing to dip their toes in the water, will find it intriguing and will want to get in deeper and will want to say, well, how else should we be looking at our customers? It's a natural starting point.
Great advice for the first step on the journey, huh? So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading or coming out?
One I'm an academic, and so maybe I'm a little biased towards books written by other academics, but I'm not talking about academic books.
Right.
I'm talking about folks like myself who try to take a lot of, you know, good, solid research, but make it accessible and motivated. So I'm looking forward to a book by my colleague at the University of Toronto, Avi Goldfarb, called Power and Prediction, The Disruptive Economics of Artificial Intelligence. And I, you know, there's a lot of hype around AI these days.
Yeah, and you all even joke about it in your book.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm joking. But so let's look at AI kind of through this lens of what kind of economic impact is it going to have, you know, on business, on society. And so I just love when thoughtful academics build that bridge between the research that we do and why it should matter to normal people. So Avi probably isn't even aware that I'm aware of his book, but I'm really excited to see it come out in a couple of weeks.
Interesting, though. I've had books on the show about AI, and of course they're full of promise and they try to be realistic, but The Disruptive Economics of Artificial Intelligence. Wow. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books you've mentioned, to your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. And now a word to you, dear listener. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to Professor Fader and congratulate him on the book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send him a message. Guests on the show have told me how much they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because, as Peter Fader knows, Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote: many companies talk about being customer-centric, but keep making the same decisions with the same logic, in the same silos, and with the same incentives. How can they be surprised when nothing changes? We are not saying there is a single prescriptive framework. Instead, we are urging you to consider the customer base audit as a catalyst for change, shifting mindsets and giving business leaders a new perspective to drive transformation. The book is The Customer Base Audit, the first step on the journey to customer centricity. The authors are Peter Fader, Bruce Hardy, and Michael Ross. Dr. Fader, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, it is such a pleasure. You are doing such a service to the field of marketing by having this series and letting me be a part of it. And I just want to double down on what you said. I hope that not only will people read the book, but get in touch with it. You know, again, we're sparking a revolution here. I'm looking for other folks to be, you know, taking up arms or audits or customer data and joining in.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a free copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you're one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."